I always used to give Owen Sheehan a good bit of grief for his power rankings. They aren't easy, Will.
As a group, as players, we have not done 1 minute of video analysis of any team this year.
The Club Championship Show. Subscribe to the GAA podcast feed on the OTB Sports app now.
Welcome to the Mike Quirk Podcast.
Now give me my theme music.
Okay, welcome again, everybody, to our fifth episode. Delighted to say I have Phil Carney on the line, and we'll have a good look into skill acquisition and different things. And Phil's obviously his base is above in Limerick and UL, and a lecturer, particularly in those kind of areas, Phil, which we'll get into. And again, for the people, I suppose, as a reminder for the people that are listening, obviously this is a fundraiser for Recovery Haven below in Tralee, Phil, an organisation who provide free cancer support services for the people of Kerry. And the podcast, thankfully, is being well received and is very popular. And again, I would encourage people that have an opportunity or that have the availability of some extra cash, we'd obviously love a donation to the fundraising page that's attached below. So, Phil, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much. Delighted to be here, both in terms of the quality of the podcast. I really enjoyed some of the previous episodes I've listened to, but also in terms of the good cause as well. It's always nice to be able to support something like that too.
For sure. Yeah. Phil, maybe for the people that aren't as familiar with you as I've become in the past couple of days, could you give us kind of a brief overview of where you're at in terms of what you've done, your research and your lecturing and different things?
Yeah, absolutely. So my main role really is to head up the Masters in Applied Sports Coaching at the University of Limerick. That's a really, really privileged position that I find myself in. Effectively, we get an intake of coaches every year. It's a two-year part-time course. So we've got kind of two groups every year coming through who are really interested in coaching, really motivated to improve their coaching, really open to share and engage. And my job is to help them, to manage their development, to support their development by engaging with research, by structuring their development process to allow them to maximize their individual development. So it's very much a bespoke master's. We talk about your coaching as the curriculum. So we'll provide support, we'll connect with research, we'll connect with a series of tasks to help you interrogate what you want to know more. But really, it's about, you know, you deciding what are the issues that you face in your coaching that you need to get better at. We'll obviously double check that those are the key issues, that this is the most important aspect. But then you and your peer group will work to develop and enhance your own coaching. So for me, you know, this is, I don't know what I'm going to face. I don't know what the issues are going to be year on year, month on month as we work through. But it's fantastic to be able to walk into a room of coaches and just light some sparks and the fire goes, and the peer group especially is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So the main work that I do is, I suppose now, is coach development in the context of that. Mm. And that's, again, is coaches coming from across a whole range of different team and individual sports as well, which again really makes and is a really important part, I think, of the experience that we can offer. So I'm doing more teaching, I'm doing more kind of coach development side of things. But yeah, as you say, my primary interest as a researcher, my passion has always been skill acquisition. Mm. So looking at how we enhance the learning of motor skills, how we fast track that process, how we help people to deliver under pressure. What is the science behind that allows, whether it's coaches or any instructors effectively, to enhance the quality of what they do. And this is, again, whether we're talking about, you know, children and their fundamental movement skills and the initial engagement in sport, whether we're talking about high performers, whether we're talking with somebody who's got a bad habit and it's really tricky to try and resolve. Again, what does the science say about the process that we can bring into it to resolve that? But also in terms of I guess, talent development is longer term skill acquisition. It's the longer term development of expertise. So increasingly as well, I've been engaged in research on that, particularly in track and field athletics, which has been my primary sport of interest. and trying to understand, you know, what that journey looks like, and look at the numbers a little bit to map out how much we know about that that journey. So that's kind of the research side, the main kind of teaching side, but I'm also really privileged in terms of the range of PhD and ProfDoc students that I'm working with. So, you know, Phil Fitzgerald is one that was on with you a couple of weeks back. He's doing some really great work in terms of maturation. Yeah. You've got Niall O'Mahony there in Tralee as well, doing some great work around games-based approaches and development. You've got another Kerryman, Carol Dillon, doing some nice work on bilateral skill in Gaelic football. You've got Rob Mulcahy, who's based in Clare, doing some really nice work in terms of talent development, talent selection in particular. So again, I'm also incredibly lucky that I get to support people with good ideas and with real passion to go and develop. And my role there is to almost step back a little bit and just be the support and be the guide rails to ensure that they can do their research and have as big as impact as they possibly can.
Yeah, that's sounds like a busy schedule, Phil. Tell me that, like, it's even just when you list off Fionn and Niall and Rob Mulcahy, it seems like there's almost a kind of a wave of research happening in a GA context. I know there maybe not all GA context, but there seems like there's a lot more of it coming now, where people are actually really digging into this stuff to see, well, what are the actual facts of it, as opposed to just the anecdotal stories that we've all kind of grown up with?
Yeah, there is. And I should say, you know, that there's a number of different pockets of this. So up in Tala, I think in TU Dublin, you've got a Gaelic Games Research Centre, which have done some great work over the years in terms of more so around kind of running mechanics and match demands of various different Gaelic games. So they've done some really great work. So you've got you know, groups in different places doing some really nice work, but I guess it's just come together really nicely that we've got a cluster of interested individuals at the moment in Gaelic games. I think part of the trigger for us as well was Paul Kinnerk's recent PhD through the University of Limerick. So he would have done that primarily with Mark Lyons as supervisor, as primary supervisor, and Stephen Harvey would have supported that as well. I was just fortunate that when I moved back to Limerick, Paul was just over halfway through that process, and I was lucky enough to get involved as part of that as well. And he's got some great answers and some great research done, but as any good project will do, it also asked more questions. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, things like Niall O'Mahony's work is addressing some of those more directly. You know, the questions that Paul has uncovered that need to be followed up and answered afterwards. I think there is a lot of work still to be done, but there's a lot of great work happening on the ground in terms of and as you say, we've got to be really careful in terms of, you know, traditional ways of doing things. Just because something has been done traditionally doesn't mean it's right. Mm-hmm. Just because something's been done that way traditionally doesn't mean it's wrong either. Mm-hmm. But this is where I come in as a scientist, and my role is to test these things. Mm. You know, so let's work with coaches. Let's find out what they think is happening and why they think it's happening. And okay, let's confirm that they're going down the right track, that these things that they think are working are genuinely working, and these things that they think or other things that they might be doing might go, do you know what? That's actually not having the effect you think it has, because humans are very susceptible to recognizing patterns or to fooling themselves. Mm. Feynman, the scientist, the physicist, very famously came out, you know, the easiest person to fool is yourself. And we are unwittingly seeing patterns, or we're thinking that something is happening. The advantage of working in terms of the scientific process is you get to just confirm. Let's stop. Let's do some real serious observation on this. Does it actually hold up? And, you know, I think when we do that, we start to winnow out those practices that are really effective and that are working, that we want to do more of. And then we start to say those practices that actually we need to let go of those. But even as I say that, that's a little bit too simplistic. Because, yeah, you know, it's not the case that there's good or bad practices. It's also about how you apply them. So it's like saying that the squat is a good or a bad exercise. No, the squat is a useful exercise for improving certain things, mm-hmm, and it's not going to help you with other things. So are you doing the right things for the right purposes in the right way? Mm-hmm. But there again is where I kind of think, you know, we're on the cusp of something in Ireland. There's lots of people, lots of coaches who are experimenting with different ways of doing things, which is fantastic. There's a real appetite to understand what's the best way of doing this. And I think we're in a really nice position now where we can bring some of the scientific methods in to confirm that these are genuinely working.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably a really nice segue into what I was, you know, looking at initially just discussing is that whole area of, you know, skill acquisition and skill development, skill acquisition. When you're talking about traditional ways of coaching, not necessarily are good or not necessarily are bad. Obviously, it's a way to kind of analyze and look at those and decide which is good and keep it, and what's less good, we can maybe discard a little bit. In terms of like the age old question that I get asked every time I'm speaking at anything is about drills versus games. And I know this is a huge area and there's lots of different rabbit holes we can go down. But can we just look at that for a couple of minutes? Because I'm very conscious of those coaches, Phil, who are coaching your under 9 basketball or you're under 14 rugby or you're under 17 Gaelic football. And we have that traditional idea in our head still, it still remains that we go with drills, and then we reward with a game at the end. That's the kind of very generic traditional model of how we coach team sports in particular. And obviously there's a lot of, you know, new thinking with regard to that about different things in terms of a games-led approach or constraints-led. What exactly are we looking at here now in terms of skill acquisition? Where do we need to keep pushing the boulder down the hill to get to?
Yeah. So, well, as you say, that there's an awful lot in that. That's a big area, and it's a contentious area as well. But one of the reasons why it's a very contentious area is, you know, you often listen to people arguing and then you go, hang on a second, are they arguing about the same thing or different things? What exactly do you mean when you're talking about drill? What exactly do you mean when you're talking about games? And actually unpacking some of these, and I think it's always useful to break it down and look at the actual practices and the nature of the practices. So that's one part. A second part is always asking the question, what are we doing this for? Mm-hmm. So what's your purpose in doing this activity? Because the purpose will shape an awful lot of whether something is appropriate or not. And then the final thing is simple economics, you know? And what I mean by that is, how many footballs have you got for your team? You know, if you're talking about, you know, one of the things I'll often hear is, you know, we need to do these kind of drills. We need to do these kind of running from around the square or in lines and doing this, that, and the other, because people need to get lots and lots of repetitions in. I'm saying, well, okay, let's park that for a moment. But, you know, have you enough footballs to give everybody a football or one football between two? Because suddenly we can get an awful lot of repetitions in now, and we don't need to be standing around in lines and waiting and so forth. So, but there's an economics piece. If you've got enough footballs, you can do this. If you haven't got enough footballs, that's an important constraint that we've got here. So there's a whole host of things that we want to consider. I guess I'll always come back to a number of principles. And one is about, you know, where learning comes from. And learning often, you know, learning is about, if you're engaged with something, if you're passionate about something, if you're motivated by something, you will learn. I always remember the conversation about, you know, my son is struggling a little bit in school. You know, he's not learning, he's not picking up the aspects that quick. And I'm like, yeah, that's fair enough. But you're talking about this kid here, is it? This kid here who can tell me all 5,000 variations of Pokemon and when you see each one and which one's better than which. This is the kid who's struggling to okay, fair enough. So there's a, you know, engagement is got to be our number one when it comes to learning. So, okay, if our goal is learning, well, number one, how do we make things engaging? And a big part of that for me is, you know, this is where the game or some form of the game comes in. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you play the game, the full game at the start, but let's play a game at the start, because we're not here. You know, I had another example where I was doing a session. It was a hurling club actually. And the coach was saying, look, I've got this kid and he's about 7 years of age, 8 years of age. And all he wants to do is take the slitter, pop it on the hurley and go for a mad run up the pitch. How do I get him, you know, to play the game of hurling? You know, and I'm like, well, hang on a second. You've got to look at this from his perspective, you know, because for him, the game of hurling isn't about passing. For him, the game of hurling is going for this mad run. This is what the excitement of the game is, the joy of the game is, you know. And if your primary goal is to engage people with football or hurling or whatever the sport is, well, what makes that, what's the joy of the game for them? Right, well, let's start with that, or let's make sure that's a big component of the session. So I think that's, you know, what's the engagement? What's the bit that really grabs their attention? That comes first. And I think the idea of the game as a reward misses a point or misses an opportunity, you know, because if the other thing I will often see when I see people doing these kind of structured line drills, I see people very quickly going through the motions and I see the quality dropping. And I hear coaches losing their voices because they have to shout so much to try and get the quality up. And going, do you know what? If you use the game and you set the situation up in the game and suddenly the player sees the need to get better at this, and you've got a player who needs and wants to improve in this area, you don't need to worry about the quality of what comes next when you kind of simplify it down or can change the practice context a little bit. Because if they know, if I can do this better here, then I can go back. This is the kid who will learn the 5,000 Pokemon, but the equivalent of that within whatever the game context is. So I think that's a second really big part of it for me, you know, that actually the motivation to focus, to pay attention, to practice will come from the game more so and much more easily than a promise of a game as a reward.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just understanding a little bit about how the mind works.
Yeah.
And the other bit then becomes, you know, what are the different ways in which we can simplify activities? Because it's absolutely essential to simplify activities. Absolutely is, you know, and I think there's an awful lot of misconceptions about what the game-based approach is and what you are allowed and not allowed to do within game-based approaches. You know, there absolutely is a case for and a place for going down and working on an action within the context of a game-based approach. And that could even be to the case of, you know, an individual child working on experimenting with a bit on their own. That's part of a game-based approach. Mm-hmm. It's a small part. It's a minimum necessary dose. You'll do as little of it as you can.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they've mastered that, then you want them moving into using it in some more applied kind of context. But, you know, we're talking about as much as possible, you're playing games, but those games could be, you know, 1v1 games, 2v1, it can be 0v1. If everybody has a football, if you've got that and you can provide that, then okay, I want you to move and I want you to visit all four sides of the square with the football, hopping and bouncing. You've got to avoid people, but you're not competing against anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's skill execution, but it's skill execution where you're adapting your movements to the requirements, but it's simplified enough. That's better. I would say absolutely that is better than somebody going through the motions of a drill type situation. However, and again, this is where you know, Niall O'Mahony is going to be a great person to talk to in a year's time when he's got a chance to process mm-hmm. through some more of his data. You know, there are times where a coach will bring players in and will run these, you know, drills and these line activities, but it's got nothing to do with learning.
Mm.
And this is really important because lots of times coaches watch these higher performance coaches or these other coaches and they assume that they're doing this to enhance learning. Whereas the coach might be saying, look, I don't know these guys and they don't know me. So I'm going to do some small grid work and drills. So I'm nice and close and I can see all of them and I can test my knowledge of their names. And they can know that I'm watching them and I'm giving them a message that I'm paying attention to them. And it allows me to communicate really effectively with them. But it's all about building a relationship, building a bond, a connection with players. It's got nothing to do with learning.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to spend 5 minutes doing some kind of maybe it's a hand passing drill, but it's not going to give us much in the way of learning.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll give me a connection that I can use further down the line.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, somebody watching from the outside must be, oh, they think that's a great drill for learning. It might have nothing to do with learning as to why they're using it. So it becomes incredibly complicated when we try and kind of distill this.
No, it is. It's obviously a massive area, and it's just one that I still think that we're probably not getting quite right as volunteer coaches in any association, in any sport. that kind of reproductive pedagogy of coaching the way that I myself was coached when I was a kid, which was probably primarily a lot of drills based activities, that those linear cone to cone, you know, hop solo or layups or pass and rugby or kick, whatever it is, that is still prevalent, as we feel that maybe that's the best way to isolate that aspect of the skill, and that's the best way for them to develop and to learn and to improve in that part of the technique, I suppose. Whereas you're saying that, look, we can obviously mimic certain situations in games that can have a similar effect. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And you know, simplify the games. If you have enough space in the game, if you have enough time around, or if there's you know, limited contact that will happen with you, then you know you still have the simplified, the less complex situation which you can do that. But critically, we're preserving the most important thing, which is that you are adapting your movement to the demands of the situation. Mm-hmm. Because that's what skill is. Mm-hmm. Skill isn't a technique. It isn't moving it in a particular way. Skill is solving the problem that the moment presents. Whether that problem is where exactly your teammate is and how fast they're running and where you need to put the ball and what pace you need to put the ball, or whether you're the cornerback and the skill is in terms of shutting down their space and stopping their forward progress and how you position yourself to do that. Skill is about adapting your movements to the demands of the situation so you solve the problem the movement presents. And this is what coaching is. Coaching is designing the appropriate problem for a player to solve. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are simple problems. You're talking about inter-county squads. These are going to be much more complex problems.
Yeah.
And it's about understanding, okay, how do I set the right level of problem for the players that I'm dealing with? Mm-hmm. And then this is where, if you're the school's coach or the club coach and the volunteer coach, yours is the hardest job. Because at the inter-county level, they're all at a certain level.
Yeah.
Whereas you're dealing with a big mix. And so at that point, okay, how do you manage to adapt? You know, how do you manage to set a challenge, set a problem that's appropriate to everybody, or put handicaps on so that everybody is given an appropriate level of challenge? And that might be as simple as, you know, yourself and myself are going up and we've got to do a series of you know, five times we're going to go and try and achieve some outcome. Okay, well, if you win 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5, you win the game. If I win 1 out of 5, I win the game.
Yeah.
Because you're taller than I am. You're stronger than I am. You're more familiar with the game than I am. But you know what? I reckon you make one mistake and I might just be able to pip you to that one.
Yeah.
And so therefore, there's still an engagement. There's still a motivation for me to engage and to practice within that. So again, it's a challenge. But this is, you know, this is the essence of good coaching. It's setting the appropriate level of challenge.
Yeah. And that's solving the problem that the moment presents is probably, you know, it encapsulates everything really in terms of what you want in a skill. But that crucially, the game, and we haven't really mentioned it, the small-sided game as opposed to the linear drill, it encapsulates decision making, which is obviously, it's almost like an underappreciated or underrecognized aspect of skill. You like, skills are irrelevant unless you have the appropriate decision making to know when is the time to execute, you know, such and such, depending on whatever that moment presents, really.
Oh, completely. I have a kind of a set of 5 questions that I ask when we're evaluating, you know, how well any activity, especially game-based activity, is running. So the first question is it safe? Because if it isn't safe, you stop and you've got to fix that straight away. Okay. Number 2, is it active? Because if majority of people aren't active, then again, this isn't working either. We need to fix that. Number 3, is it inclusive? So again, we don't want a game to be played where there's got 1 or 2 people and they've got no involvement whatsoever. We need to make some change to bring them and make them inclusive. Okay, if all that is happening, then we go, okay, number 4, are there good decisions being made? Because if there aren't good decisions being made, then that's our next step. You know, why not? What is it? Is it they don't see decisions or they don't have enough space? Okay, well, that's the bit we need to fix. Only once we go through those 4 questions, only at that stage do we ask, and are there good movements being made? Because the movement depends on the decisions that are available. If you see better decisions, if you're making better decisions, then you'll often find people will transform their skills that they're executing. They will show you skills that you didn't realize that they had once you open up their capacity to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. But the movements that you make, they follow on from the decisions that you make. They follow on from the situations that you find yourself in. So it is absolutely, for me, number one, you know, go run through that cascade. But, you know, movements are the last thing you think about trying to fix and change, because so much is happening. The movements are the consequence of so many other things that are happening earlier on in the process. You don't want to be fixing something that's a symptom. You want to be fixing the cause. So what's the root cause? And oftentimes that's the, you know, you fix the decisions and the movements take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. And is it, what way do we look at this in terms of the different age groups? I'm conscious now that I probably have there's a large different spectrum of people in their coaching journey that listen to this. So you have people that are probably starting out that are under sevens or under nines. And then you probably have people that are coaching much, much older people. In terms of that kind of approach all the way through, is it a little bit more prescriptive as we're younger and less so as we get older, or what's the appropriate kind of, you know, approach for coaches?
Yeah, so I think I again I'll come back and number one, what's engaging for these different groups? So, you know, if you always start by thinking about, can I make this engaging first and foremost? Mm-hmm. If it's engaging, we'll get learning that follows after that. Learning won't be a fight if it's engaging. Mm-hmm. So whatever I do, I want to make it engaging. In terms of, is it a bit more prescriptive? I guess the way I think about it is, you know, the nature of the problems that you solve might be a bit, or that you set as a coach might be a bit simpler. Mm. It's simpler problems that you're setting. However, you know, if you, and so a couple of years back, I was coaching a lot of 6 and 7 year olds. Now, it was an athletics club and it looked nothing like athletics because they're 6 and 7. It shouldn't look anything like athletics. Yeah. But one of the things we do a lot of is variations in different types of chasing games. Mm-hmm. And the sophisticated behavior, the tactical behavior that you would see, the decision-making that you would see in terms of the timing of a run, the patience and waiting, and now we make the run, in terms of the shadowing or teamwork to close down and limit the use of space for somebody. The sophistication of behaviors is fantastic. If you saw that in a football field, you think these guys really have it. Mm. And all we've done is simplified the game by reducing it down to a really simple game of chasing, but they're capable of very sophisticated behaviors. So I think my key bit is, you know, don't underestimate what children are capable of. And always try and work at whatever they're, give them as much challenge as they can handle. And they'll very often surprise you in terms of how much challenge they can handle. The other bit then, in terms of, I guess we often get asked, you know, look, I like this idea of a game-based approach, but we need to spend more time on maybe some of the basic technical stuff first. Mm. You know, the first one, and I can't remember who said it, but they talked about, you know, learning is like, you know, your fingernails growing. It's happening. You don't always realize it. You don't always see it, but it's happening. Sometimes it can be a little bit messy and you're wondering, you walk out of a session, you go, geez, did anything good happen there? Mm. But 2-3 weeks of chaos later, and you start to see, okay, it's starting to come together. It's starting to click. So I think when you're coaching at the youth level in particular, there's an element of patience is so important for coaches, and an element of just trust in the process is so important for coaches. The other really important skill acquisition principle is that how well somebody performs in the moment, how well somebody performs in one session, tells us very little about how much they're learning. You can be performing really well and be learning very little. You can be performing quite poorly and messily, and it doesn't look like anything's sticking, but you're actually learning quite a bit. Mm-hmm. If we want to assess learning, we assess learning by what you bring back to the next session. Not what you can do in this session, but how much you remember, how much you bring back in the next session. Because there are many things that we can do that will artificially boost performance. If I get you to take 10 free throws in a row, 7, 8, 9, 10 are probably going to be better than 1, 2, 3, 4. Why? Well, because you're just doing the same thing over and over again, your body will get used to that. But if I want to know how much that you've learned, how good you are, I don't judge it on the basis of free throw 7, 8, 9, 10. I judge it on the basis of start of the next session up to the free throw line. You've got two shots. That's what tells me whether you've learned or not. Mm-hmm. And so this is what we need to be thinking about in terms of actually judging the effectiveness of our coaching. If it looks really good in the moment, don't be fooled. Remember, I said at the start, the easiest person to fool is yourself. If it looks really good, it looks like it's working really smoothly, we've got all this done, that doesn't mean they're learning anything. How do you know if they've learned? Okay, do you know what? What's the first activity you're going to design at the start of the next session? Don't tell them. Just let it run and see, has it stuck? Do you see what you've been working on? And but the exact same thing applies in terms of, you know, you're watching a match and you draw your conclusions after a match and you say, you know what, the three things that we've got an issue with here are 1, 2, and 3. Now that could be the case, or it could be the case that they're just having a bad day. Mm. So start of the next session. Okay, let's start your session with a game or a game form. It doesn't have to be the full game, but a simplified game form that will reveal whether that particular issue, maybe it's, you know, players aren't making forward runs appropriately. Okay, set it out. Do you see the same thing happening again? If you see the same thing happening again, you've just confirmed, okay, that's an issue. That's definitely something I need to pay attention to. But by starting your session with that game form, not leaving it as a reward to the end, but starting the session, now you're using it for two reasons. Number one, you're assessing what the players have learned. Number two, you're checking the quality of your assessment. Did I assess them correctly the last day? Are they at where I thought they were? And number three, now when you want to have a conversation with the players and we want to work on something today, it's fresh in their minds. What did you notice? Oh, no one was making a run for me. No one was making a run. Why not? Was the market, what was happening here? So we got a conversation going. Right. So now we got to work on the next part of this session about fixing that problem, which you've all just identified. You know what's happening. You've seen it. You've experienced it. We're motivated. We're ready to work on it. So you're kind of starting the session with more of some form of a game has multiple benefits. Mm. And I think that's kind of another aspect. I know I've kind of deviated from whatever the initial question was, but
yeah, I can't even remember the initial question, but it's all very relevant, obviously. And it's context is probably the crucial thing, that the games are giving you context. And then obviously to go back and to reassess it, obviously not on the same night, but to look at that again and again, obviously, and again, that you have to keep going and assessing that. Like how long, and this is a bit like how long is a piece of string, I suppose, but like if I'm talking about a recurring issue, let's say it's a decision making issue that we're not happy with our shot selection in basketball or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And that's an area that we're focusing on through our games, and we're designing tasks to specifically look at this aspect. How long are we expecting or are we hoping before we start to see an improvement in that area? Obviously, it's very dependent on the players and the ages and different things. But what's a kind of a, you know, to give hope to some coaches who are looking down this avenue to say, this is what I really want to do?
I know you desperately want me to give you hope, but if I was inside in the office, this literally is where I'd open the drawer and take out my piece of string, which I have for exactly this purpose.
Yeah.
No, this is the thing about learning.
Yeah.
You know, it's nonlinear. We don't know how long it takes. Sometimes it can click and it can be really smooth and this is fantastic and enjoy those days. They don't happen very often. Sometimes it can be painfully slow, but that doesn't mean it isn't going to get there. It isn't going to happen. It sometimes it does. Sometimes you need to take a break, go away and do something else. And then you come back to it again and suddenly it's all come together without you thinking about it. You know, that's the formal name for it is reminiscence. It's something that we know and it happens. It's a well-established phenomenon in terms of learning and memory. Sometimes things come together following a break where the you know, you were working on it and it just wasn't coming together. It wasn't clicking. There's a number of possible reasons why that might be happening. But again, it's just one of those things. Sometimes, and every coach will have met this at some stage in something in his life, you were working away at something, it wasn't happening, you took a break, you walked back, and it all came together. that same thing applies for players learning as well. So this is the really important, because you know, coaching is extremely difficult, right? Let me rephrase that one. Coaching is extremely complex. Okay. There's so many parts to it. You can make it more difficult or less difficult. You can, you know, depending on how you manage it. You know, people who are really well organized have a really good process and know what they're doing. They have a good plan set out that helps them to manage the complexity of it. But what's really important for a coach is to be paying attention. So what's happening here? Is this a case where I need to keep going with this? Well, what are the things that might be indicating to me that the players are still engaged, that I can keep going with this and they're not going to be getting tired of it and getting annoyed with it? Or what are the signs that say maybe I need to take a short break from this? Or what are the signs that say, you know, so literally it's about learning to just pay attention to the group. And again, the difficulty with coaching is the signs for one group might be completely different to the signs for another group. And so this is just part of the complexity of coaching.
Yeah, I suppose I would have spoke to Frank Dick last week or the week before, and he would have spoke about, you know, those skills that you can be taught and those skills that you have to learn, and those people skills, I suppose, you know, are that's kind of what you're speaking about in one sense, that you just have to go through that and gain experience and find out when it is time to take a break or when it is time to push on a little bit. And that's the trick of it. And that's the frustration of it, because you never know exactly when you're going to get there, obviously.
There's definitely the frustration aspect of it, but I think we can fast track that as well. So in one sense, I fully agree in terms of, you know, you can't learn this stuff without practicing it, without being in the moment engaged. You can't. But, and this is the value of having a peer group, having coaches that you're discussing with. You can learn, you can fast track your learning through conversations around, you know, geez, listen, I'm working on this thing. We're working on our shot selection and it's just not clicking, you know? At what point would you keep going? Would you stop and move on to something else? Or what would you be looking for that lets you say that it's okay? And having that conversation, what are the specific details? Just really get drilled down into the details with another coach. You know, what are you seeing? What are you watching for? And they might come back to you and go, do you know what? I haven't really paid enough attention to that, but let me watch this week and see how people are reacting. And then we'll have a chat next week. But I think those informal conversations are so important. And I think there's such opportunity to learn, and no situations will ever be the same. Mm. No two situations will ever be the same, but you might recognize some similarities. That was similar to what Mike was saying the other day. I wonder if I tried that solution or adapted that slightly, that might work. And so I think this is where, you know, coaching not being something you do on your own, but something that you do in conversation with others, it can just really make a massive difference to how quickly you learn and how quickly you manage to convert your experiences to learning. Because people can have an awful lot of experiences and not learn much from it.
Yeah.
But those conversations are a really critical piece in being able to just tune in your attention to where the key bits of information might be that you need to pay a bit more attention to, that suddenly reveals there's a solution to me. There's something I can do. There's some information I need to pay attention to. Mm.
Valuable resource, obviously, but I wonder, is there enough of that happening in I know it's probably largely anecdotal at this stage, but is there enough of that happening in clubs or in counties? Obviously in counties it's difficult no matter the sport, because everybody is so parochial, they're looking after the information that they have themselves that will help my own team, and I don't want to help your team or your club, but certainly within clubs, you know, that idea of a community of practice or even more informal and just having a chat on a Sunday after training or whenever it is, like that is a really rich resource if people were willing to tap into it.
It can be incredibly rich. So Anna Marie McCarthy is just completed her master's with us. And as part of her research project, she studied one club and they had implemented Gaelic for Girls initiative. And she was did a case study of a group of a club that had done this really, really well, that had really made an impact. And part of the reason why it worked so well for their club was that club community of practice, how the coaches came together, how they interacted with each other, how they went, you know, I'm having a little bit of trouble implementing this bit. What are you trying? What are you trying? So they had their little bit of a coffee morning or a get together where they could just work out and puzzle those things out. And it's a practical example of a club that did this and that really valuably or really benefited from doing that little, that exercise together. I think that there's an acknowledgement that this is really important. There's an acknowledgement that we don't know enough about it. Fortunately, so Will Harmon down with LGFA down in Kerry as well. So he's actually done some really nice work on that. And so again, that's something that's that will be coming out more over the coming years. But Will's work, and for me, you know, if anybody wants to understand that whole community practice process better, you cannot find anywhere anyone better than Will, just to give you some real practical guidance into how it does. This is the really exciting thing for me, you know, since moving back to Ireland, since getting involved in the master's program, the richness of coaching and coach expertise, coach development expertise that we have on this island that we don't always champion or recognize is extraordinary. There are some really fantastic coaches, coach developers, practitioners that are doing some great work here. And a lot of it isn't about, you know, we need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
No, we just need to recognize and champion more of the good stuff that's already happening.
Yeah. And push it out there and let people know that this is what's happening. And this can be very, very beneficial if you actually engage in it and see how it can apply to your own context or your own club or your own team. And it's great. And geez, it seems most of Kerry seems to be stuck in your research, which is great. I wrote down there a minute ago when we were talking about skill acquisition, just to jump back a tiny little bit, because I know that's a really big part for people. I wrote down about a PlayStation game, and it was a great story I'd heard before about the difference between your traditional football, basketball, rugby sessions, your team sport, soccer, to that of a PlayStation game like Minecraft or Fortnite or one of these. And how those games do such a really good job, and obviously the people that are paid to design them do a really good job of satisfying the kids' needs for, you know, a competence related to this autonomy, and really do a great job of allowing them to move forward or to move back and to pause and go again and keep practicing in a level until they get it back and they get over it and they move on to the next level, which is slightly harder. And it's I just found it a really good kind of a metaphor for nearly where we should be going in terms of that games-based approach again to our training sessions, that there's so many lessons that you can actually take from those games that are so engaging, as you talked about, and how they suck the kids in and how they want to get better at them. And games really allow us to... I have a big thing. I would have done my master's on looking at autonomy supportive environments. And I have a big thing about autonomy and how powerful that can be, obviously, for our you know, the impact on our own motivation. And I just see the game and through that PlayStation idea, and I have my kids my own age that are 11 and 9 or whatever, and sure they did play the PlayStation all day long if they got the chance. But I just see it as such a powerful tool because of the way the game is designed. And the point you made about designing your game or your practice related specifically to what the need or the ability of those kids are, I think is a really, really important point to make.
Yeah, and you know, to build in your point as well about the opportunities for autonomy, what the opportunities for you to shape. So it becomes your training session as well. I might come back to that in a second. I think one of the bits for me that we don't do a good enough job of, I say, I've talked about that there are people that are resources within the Irish environment that we're not promoting enough. But I also think that there's research out there, and people often have this conception of research as, you know, oh, it's this distant, it's removed from the field, it's removed from the playing pitch. Nothing could be further from the truth in terms of coaching science research now, where it's going. And so a really specific example in terms of what you're talking about, there's an English researcher, she has her doctorate now, called Amy Price, came through soccer as the sport in choice, but her whole research started because she was playing around with the ideas of, as a soccer coach, how can I apply these video game design principles into the design of my sessions? And her research now is basically documenting how to do this. Here's how any coach can take. So there's a how-to guide. Here's some different types of games that you can play. Here are the different, ways in which players can take some time out and they can practice some individual bits and then come back into the main game. They can freeze. She has like superpower rewards if you're younger kids, and all these, this is how you can adapt this into your coaching. So Amy Price is her name, and she has done an absolutely wonderful job. But this is the kind of resource that exists, that's there, that we're not doing enough of to make it's accessible in and of itself, but just to encourage its uptake. Because as you say, there's loads of coaches who are hungry for that kind of material, who want to do something like that. The answers, a lot of the time, the answers are there, but I think we don't have enough time, which is kind of pointing towards those answers that already exist.
Yeah.
And then the other bit, I think the really important bit, for me is, especially if we're talking 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 year olds, it applies to everybody. Okay. But it can apply right down that age as well. How are they shaping the session that they're in? It's their session. Okay. Now, they're not going to shape everything. I'm not saying that the coach doesn't know better in some respects. Your kids will play PlayStation every day. If you gave them full autonomy over what to eat for dinner, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't hit the nutritional guidelines that we're after either. Okay. So we have to curtail the amount of choice that they have, but we can give them quite a lot of choice within that. And so this for me is a massive part, especially if we want, 16, 17, 18 year olds that we can have really good, sophisticated conversations with, who can make good choices and contribute to the discussion and talk to us about what they're seeing. If we want really, really sophisticated conversations there, well, in the same way that we have progressions for skills leading up to that, well, we need progressions for the discussions that athletes can have, the level of autonomy that we give them right the way up to that. So that literally means if we're talking about 7, 8-year-olds, okay, do you want to have another go at this activity or do you want to move on to the next activity now? What are the simple choices that you can give so they walk out thinking, well, that was our session because we got to pick what to do and when to do it and which one to start with. These are simple choices, the choices that you can give that, as I'm sure your research showed as well, have very positive influences on motivation, return participation, and learning.
Yeah, huge. And I like we spoke about questioning with a number of different people, and they've all highlighted the, I suppose, how it's still an underutilized tool for us in coaching, that we still don't spend enough time actually thinking about the questions that we ask and then asking enough questions as opposed to prescribing. But that idea of autonomy and starting at those age groups is so, so important, because look, the numbers would say that we're losing too many kids at those teenage years. And why are we losing too many kids? And the point you made about engagement, I think is still the key one, because we're probably not engaging them enough. There's lots of other reasons, obviously, but that's a key coaching one, that they're probably just not being engaged enough in the whole process, that they're not being given, the keys to drive the car a little bit more, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I think, and that can be a little bit scary at times.
Yeah.
For the coach, in terms of, I want you to hand over the keys, but again, where is it appropriate? What can you hand over the keys to? And then, excuse me. I guess the message I make is, the more autonomy you give, the more trust they earn, the more autonomy you can give, and the more rewarding, not just they will find the sessions, but you will find the sessions as well, because they're going to be partners now, really, really good partners in designing the activities and shaping the activities and in driving the learning forwards. And it could be a really rich and rewarding experience. But it starts with, okay, how do I give little bits of autonomy and then just keep on building that as they go?
Yeah. Phil, I'm conscious of the time now, so I won't delay you too much longer, but in terms of other things, so I've probably labored the skill development or skill acquisition stuff, but in terms of other areas that you've seen in the research or through the coaches that you're dealing with that are probably, big areas or a couple of highlight areas that maybe just to look at before we finish up, is there anything that kind of jumps out at you as something that, we can do a little bit better or we need to work on?
I think, well, it goes back to one of the points we were talking about in terms of maybe coaches talking to each other a bit more.
Yeah.
One of the exercises that we do, so one of the topics that we cover very broad topics on the first semester in the master's program, but one of the topics is relationships. Now that could be anything. It could be coach-athlete relationships, athlete-athlete relationships, coach-parent relationships, coach-coach relationships. So very broadly defined. The exercise I do is I get the coaches to write a little vignette, a little scenario of a situation that you've encountered, either directly or you're familiar with the situation. And it's got to be an anonymous situation, so nobody can recognize it. But it's a real problematic situation. You're thinking, geez, how would you deal with this? And I want you to pose this to the rest of the group as, you know, let's try and get them stumped. It's going to be really tricky. How would you sort this one out? And this year was a really interesting one in terms of problematic players. About half of the examples that came up were all around problematic players. And so I think, and I'm not necessarily saying the issue is that there's a whole race of problematic players coming through the system, but I think I'm saying is the conversations that we had and the strategies that people came up with and the things to try out was really, really rich. The answers didn't come from me, didn't come from the research. The answers came from getting some good problems on the table and then getting a discussion. How would you address those? How would you deal with those? Okay, that's something to go and experiment with. And I think that process for me, actually, that's the one. An awful lot of the answers are there, common sense for an awful lot of the basic questions and the basic problems the coaches face. But I think we just need a bit better mechanism in order to share what those scenarios, share what those problems are, and then get some discussions going on that. I think that mechanism, I think, is really key if we want to see a lot of coaches getting the small boost of confidence, small boost of advice in terms of where they can go and develop. I think that mechanism for me about coach conversations and finding a way to do that within clubs, ideally across sports. And I love what Elaine Cahill in cycling, Liliana O'Hora in athletics, Kira O'Connor in rowing. There's a couple of other sports as well involved in female sports coaching networks. And these are cross-sport female cross coaching networks. They're doing a really excellent job in starting that process. So that there are models there. I think that's what I'm really excited about, seeing those models grow. I think there's huge potential in those.
Yeah. Yeah. And the ultimate goal, I suppose, really, Phil, is to try and keep as many kids playing sport, no matter what the sport is, for as long as possible. And hopefully for longer than, you know, the numbers would suggest that they are playing right now. And like, if it's cross sports, I think that's even better again, because you're dealing with problems that you'd never encounter in GAA or in soccer and basketball. And there are probably some of those that are unique only to those sports. And at least by having a conversation with people in other sports, you're solving problems before they ever arise in your own sport, you know?
Yep. Or, you know, other sports might have very good solutions.
Yeah.
But they're caught within that one sport. And so actually these are simple models that we don't have to go and reinvent the wheel. Actually, there's a really good solution just over there. But if we don't talk to the swimming coach, then we don't find out about that solution exists.
Yeah.
And as you say, I mean, you know, it's about keeping as many kids as possible involved, because, you know, the other really strong aspect, and this is part directly from my research, you know, when you're looking at kids at 11, 12, 13 years of age, you've no idea. No idea what their potential is. You have no idea where they can go. You know, anyone who pretends that they do, I'm sorry. This is where I'll come as the scientist, armed with my reams of data, yeah. And I'll have an argument with anybody. Yeah. But you better bring your data with you as well. but this is the one where, you know, this is what sport is about. So, you know, we track. There's a great study in Canada tracking. Oh, about 30,000 kids born in Ontario back in the 70s, and looking at them all the way through to ice hockey, and how many of them play a complete season or a career, five seasons worth in National Hockey League. And of the 30,000 kids that started, we're talking about 0.018% went on and had the top high performance career. Now, it's a little bit different, because, you know, professional career isn't the only, you know, elite high performance sport.
Yeah.
Probably the most professional athlete I've ever known was nowhere near international level, but he absolutely maximized his potential.
Mm-hmm.
He got everything he could out of his ability and his potential. And he was a role model to train with, to watch. This guy was absolutely exemplary.
Right.
But you'll never know of him. But he was, well, I mean, he would have been happier with an Olympic medal, but he was, yeah. You know, but he got satisfaction from pursuing his personal yeah. best and that. So that there's, you know, we need to value that aspect of it as well. But, you know, even if we group the personally referenced excellent group with the elite referenced excellence group, that's still a really small proportion.
Mm.
We've got to understand that the benefits of sport, the life skill benefits of sport, again, talk to Aaron O'Connell, who's one of our graduates about life skills, absolutely tremendous character. And his knowledge and his practical advice in terms of developing life skills. The knowledge is there for all these broader benefits of sport. We just need to get that knowledge out, and we just need to make sport an engaging place, as you say, to keep as many in there as possible so we get the opportunities to develop these broader benefits as well.
Yeah, and that's why Fionn's stuff is so interesting. Fionn Fitz is obviously in that whole area of maturation and looking at a kid that's 11 or 12 or 13 or 14, and depending on where they are in that maturation scale, you know, sure, you just have no idea. And I always, when people start talking to me about, you know, this kid is going to be really good, or I look at, like, Tom Brady was drafted 199th, like, in the NFL draft. And, like, Tom Brady has gone on to be the greatest quarterback that ever played American football, which probably isn't an argument. And professional scouts picking a guy who was 18 or 19 years of age picked 198 players ahead of him. Like, we really have no clue at 11 or 12 or 13 years of age who are the kids that are going to be, you know, international senior athletes or inter-county footballers or international rugby. But it doesn't, we just don't know. We think we do, but we really don't.
And well, it gets worse than that, because, you know, you take a look each year about how many of the Super Bowl players, the stat comes out every year, how many of them are undrafted.
Yeah.
You know? And you're talking at least 25%, despite the fact this is a country where they are rating all the high school players onwards. Yeah. They've got probably 10 years data of rating of them. Mm-hmm. And even then they can't tell. What chance have we got? I think we need to be very careful with systems that we have, you know, that we're not so caught up with, you know, did you play minor? Did you play under 21? Yeah. That we're not closing our system down too narrow too soon.
Yeah.
I think there's so many, you know, so Rob's work, Fionn's work in terms of the maturation aspects and the biases, there's an awful lot of really interesting research being asked about how do we shape that process? How do we, because I don't think development squads or school systems, school programs, they're not going away. So how do we enrich them? How do we make them, you know, really valuable, so that it doesn't matter whether somebody goes and makes it to an intercounty squad or not, but they get life benefits out of it, which really stand to them and stand to society as well. I think there's, and this is one of the big misnomers, you know, you don't get life skills out of sport automatically. You can. Sport can be incredibly powerful for developing life skills and broader benefits, but it doesn't happen automatically. It requires good coaches who have a plan for developing life skills. And if they haven't, then there's a missed opportunity. And this is something for me, again, in terms of, you know, what I'd love to see if we're talking, you know, 5-10 years time, what's a big change in Irish coaching, that you could sit down with any Irish grassroots coach and they'll tell you as much about life skill development as they'll tell you about technical, tactical skill development, because that's within their power to shape and develop within young people. Mm. There's loads of guidance out there available now to help them shape that. And they can have a really powerful and really rewarding influence on young people as well. And I think in the academic community in Sport Ireland, we've got work to do to continue to promote the good work that's out there, to make sure that it reaches coaches who, again, I think are hungry for the tools to be able to make that difference.
Yeah. And just to finish on that point, I suppose, Phil, like, where do people, if if I'm coaching an under 10 team and I'm hungry for this kind of knowledge, like where can I go to find that research? Where can I go and read this in something that I can understand now, not that's going to baffle me with jargon or with whatever else? Where can I find something that can actually make a tangible change to the way that I coach in terms of the research?
So I do think we need to get better at this, as I say. I think there's a couple of places which are starting to evolve and starting to host some nice elements. One of the one places I've been highlighting a lot recently is an organization called iCoach Kids.
Yeah.
So iCoach Kids provide both they've a website, they have a YouTube channel with a host of kind of videos and little accessible bite-sized aspects. For me, they're one of the groups that do a really good job in terms of collating some really good practical advice. We're starting to see some more international sites develop. So I mentioned Aaron O'Connell, who's done his work on life skills. He published some really nice stuff on a website called Sports Coach America recently. And they've got some nice accessible pieces there as well. But I do think that we could do a better job in Ireland in terms of actually, you know, across national governing bodies, across Sport Ireland, just hosting and highlighting and signposting. And it's a collating as opposed to anything else. But here are some really good accessible resources for people. I think but there's a shortage there. There's definitely a shortage. But, you know, you're doing some nice podcasts, and so, you know, stuff like this as well.
Yeah,
definitely does help make that accessible. Yeah.
But like, it's just I'm like, I like there's some really interesting stuff going on, and it would just be so great to be able to sit down on a Monday night or whatever, and instead of turning on the TV, read something for a couple of minutes about some piece of research about, you know, whatever, communities of practice or games-based coaching and new information that's coming out all the time. It is just, I know there's people obviously that would like to get that, their hands on that stuff, and that's all. We can do a better job obviously about pumping that out there and pumping it out there in a way that is more accessible to people, I suppose, and understandable by people. I'm going to finish the last one, Phil, and I'm going to let Sorry, go ahead.
I will jump in on this one as well, though, because this is a big part of kind of Movement Skill Acquisition Ireland, the group that I made at the conference that we ran. You know, actually, the information is one part, but it's what do you do with that information? It's the kind of the follow-up that's really essential. So how are you going to experiment with this in your practice? How are you going to put this into practice? Who are you going to talk to about it? You know, so I think the information is one piece.
Yeah.
But this is where, again, is where the peer networks and the champions and somebody who goes, you said you were going to play around with that. How did it go? That's really important to make sure it becomes more than just a nice idea, but something that gets integrated into practice.
Yeah, I got you. Last one. I'm giving you a magic wand in terms of skill acquisition in sports in Ireland. You have the power. I'm giving you a serious magic wand. What is the one significant change that you want to see happening in the next 10 years in terms of skill acquisition in sport in Ireland? Now, that's a serious responsibility I'm after giving you, Phil. So, you know, give me something good.
That's a dangerous amount of power that you're pushing my direction. I'll be really careful with that one. I'm actually going to come back. So if I could affect one change,
yeah,
you know, magic wand, wave that overnight, and okay, what happens next? I'm actually going to go back to something I said earlier. You know, so that we don't judge how much someone's learned on the basis of how well they're performing. We judge it on the basis of how much they bring back to the next session. Now, if I could wave a magic wand so that every coach in the country, suddenly they goes, no, that looks nice, but I'm not judging how much they've learned yet. I'm going to wait. You might think that's a really basic piece. But suddenly, the knock-on consequences of that are really, really powerful. Suddenly, coaches don't value methods that give you a short-term boost in performance. They value methods that bring about long-term learning. And so actually, if coaches just pause and wait, defer judgment on whether something is working or not until they actually see what comes back, it'll allow them to judge methods much more effectively. They won't get fooled by those methods. Mm-hmm. And these are the methods we see all the time. Coaches talk too much. Coaches don't ask enough questions. Coaches simplify drills too much. All those things will be found out as not working well enough if coaches just defer judgment on how much learning is happening until the next training session. So it sounds like a really simple thing, but that would be my use of the magic wand. Coaches would know to defer judgment, because so many good things will come from just understanding and applying that one basic principle.
Brilliant. Phil, that was magic. Again, thanks a million for your time. I probably kept you a couple of minutes longer than I had intended, so apologies if I've kept you late for something. For the people that were listening, folks, again, I know I keep saying I'm like a broken record at this stage, but obviously this is a fundraiser primarily for Recovery Haven in Tralee. And if you have found some value in that episode or in any of the episodes, again, I would ask that maybe you could find your way to make a donation to the link that's in the podcast description below or on my podcast or on my Twitter page at Mike Quirk. And again, everything raised goes directly to Recovery Haven. So it would be most appreciated by them and by me. Phil, again, thanks a million for your time. Really appreciate it. I found that insightful, man. Really fascinating. And I'm sure everybody else will too. So thanks again for that.
Really enjoy the chat. Thanks for having me on, Mike.